Chapter 1. The sun was only just rising over the high desert of northern Kandahar as the jeep that carried Captain Tony Rodriguez ground up the gravelly roads towards the headquarters of Drun Gargashti, tribal leader of the local subclan and organizer of those few local farmers still opposed to the United States Army's proposed plans for a more robust system of reservoirs and a more reliable infrastructure for aqueous resources in the area. Tony sighed as he looked over his shoulder at his driver. Major Lewis Riker, a humorless man whose pursed lip and stony demeanor suggested that he would rather be anywhere, doing anything else this early in the day. Not that Tony could blame him too much. The negotiations that had been going so well in the region had stalled out hard about 3 months ago when Drun was convinced by a coterie of his tribesmen that any negotiations with the army were a ploy, meant purely to enable a larger U.S. presence. That was why Tony had been called here as a civilian affairs officer from his normal post at Northern Command. All the other negotiators had failed, in large part because the men like Major Riker, who'd been entrusted with their execution, didn't have the mediator's ability for compromise and dialogue that Tony had. Unlike Tony, they were blunt, forceful men, hardened by decades of deployment and combat operations, impatient with the slog that Afghanistan had become, and eager to put an end to what they disparagingly called the Forever War. Tony understood their frustrations because he'd lived them firsthand. Afghanistan had been one of his first major deployments as an Air Force private, way back in 2003, and though he'd started out optimistic about the operations, after his first year abroad, he'd grown cynical at his inability to make change happen. The more entrenched U.S. forces became there, the more they seemed to make enemies, each single hard-earned gain only seeming to result in 20 more losses or complications. An engineer by training, disposition, and profession, Tony had found the bull-headed approach to conflict resolution so frustrating that in the middle of one arbitration with a particularly anti-American faction he'd been instructed to talk into total surrender or bomb into oblivion, he'd simply stopped following the protocol he'd been given, interrupting his CO to instead offer the combative warlord they'd been sent to bamboozle provisions and the protective wing of Uncle Sam's armed forces. It had been a major gamble, no doubt, and a massive breach of protocol that nearly got him shot on the spot, but it had been a gamble that paid off massively. In putting his engineer's gift for problem-solving to work, not towards dominance and authority, but towards mutual agreement and aid, Tony ended up making the exact kind of political inroads necessary that secure a major supply route that linked two of the Army's most alienated bases in the region. While the unauthorized concessions he'd offered had nearly earned him a court-martial, the results and goodwill his efforts had generated among the locals had proven so momentous that a handful of men, even higher up than his immediate CO, recognized the worth of such an operative in this region. Within the next year, Tony had earned a reputation among his comrades for his silver tongue and as a savvy thinker, who could be called in to pull even the most hopelessly mired of situations out of the mud, and a level of respect among the many, many factions dotting the region as a man worthy of trust. It wasn't that Tony was duplicitous, though he'd more than once been told to make promises that would end up broken. Tony had always managed to adhere to the word of his COs while keeping true to his own spirit as a mediator. Unfortunately, he couldn't be everywhere at once, and over time had found his talents more in demand in Colorado and Northern Command, where he found a real calling for civilian engineering, particularly where water was concerned. His years in the desert had shown him how essential this resource was to everything, from agriculture to military operations to the basics of everyday life, and in doing so, had given him a deep appreciation and deeper passion for handling all things concerning water. Sadly, his own methods and loves had not trickled down to the rest of the men in Afghanistan, and his reputation, which had been so strong while he'd been positioned here, had waned in the years since he'd been gone, so much that even the men he'd once trained for this kind of operation had lost much of the skills he'd helped to cultivate. In fact, it was exactly such a generation of soldiers he was responsible for overseeing now, and who occupied the jeeps that trailed behind his and Major Riker's own. Glancing up in the rearview mirror and staring through the glare, Tony could just make out the bristly, frustrated grimace on Commander McLaren's face and the barely disguised fear bubbling under the surface of his driver's expression. Though he could not see them from here, Tony imagined that the soldiers riding along in the jeep at the rear of their caravan were similarly off-put by this encounter. Not that he would blame them if he had still been 20 years younger and in their shoes. During his meteoric rise, Droon had earned a reputation for being difficult to work with. Not violent, as some of the more baseless rumors suggested, no, but clever, confrontational, willing to wheedle and insult and undercut the authority and force of the army officers sent to negotiate with him. He was much younger than the average leader in these parts, and cannier, possessed of a charisma and following rare even among older leaders Tony had once found so amenable to real, sustained cooperation. A dozen times he had brokered deals with the army forces that had seemed airtight until the moment he revealed that they'd been riddled with loopholes that benefited him while setting back American forces weeks, if not months, in their planning. It didn't help that his success and his charisma had won him the respect of many of the same elders who'd once written him off as a young thug, enough that they now pledged themselves to guaranteeing their support if he was ever betrayed by the Americans. Force was no option, though, for while Droon was by no means a violent man, he had a sizable and well-armed following that made it clear they weren't going to be steamrolled by intimidation, a fact Tony observed for himself as they pulled up and parked in front of Droon's latest encampment. Lesser members of the sub-clan's leadership milled around outside, the displeasure on their faces plain, even under the shadows of their Peshwari caps and their turbans. Tony found it hard to blame them. The sight of three jeeps and the camo-clad soldiers inside of them pouring out into the front lawn of a local leader was a hard one to stomach for even some of the most sympathetic Afghani citizens, let alone men who had, Tony suspected, at some point or another, lost family to American intervention these last few decades. He'd met most of them in his preliminary dealings so far, but it was only Rishteen, whose wild red curls made him immediately recognizable, whom he knew well enough that he felt comfortable calling him by name, and who now smiled to see Tony stepping down from the car.
"It's a pleasure to see you this morning, friend," Rishteen said to Tony, as he offered him his hand.
Tony smiled, said, "Don't lie to me, Rishteen. You were hoping my ugly mug had been replaced with some pretty young thing, huh?" and pulled his laughing friend into a hug. The two had first met back in 2003, when Tony was in Afghanistan for his first tour, and though Rishteen was a fair bit older, then a respectable 35 to Tony's naive 21, the men had found a kinship in their level-headed approach to problem-solving. Others, be they his family or the American forces, liked to joke that Rishteen was as fiery of temperament as his red curls suggested, but there was no grounding for that reputation. The truth is that he was a keenly analytical mind who knew as well how to placate and play on the emotions of others as he did how to deconstruct an argument or examine a complex arrangement for its weaknesses and its strengths.
"Normally, yes, though under these circumstances, perhaps it's better to have someone of your rockier disposition accompanying me."
"That bad, huh?" Tony said, knowing full well from the looks the other farmers shot him and the rest of the army entourage that they would have as soon driven them off the property with pitchforks if it hadn't been for Rasheen convincing Droon to trust Tony. And I guess we have you to thank for that. What have you been telling them, Rasheen? The sprightly older man returned his young friend's joke with a toothy grin and a jest of his own.
Only that you and your friends come bearing a profitable arrangement for an opium farm you would generously allow us to keep 5% of the proceeds from. I tried to tell them it was a better deal than they'd get anywhere else, but, well, you can see the results for yourself.
Before Tony could offer his own response, though, Lieutenant Riker had inserted himself between the two men. "Rasheen," he said, offering his hand, which the old man took with an equally firm but less than amused shake.
"Thank you for organizing this meeting." "It's no great trouble, but where's Commander McLaren? I was under the impression that this meeting was all happening under his auspices."
Riker cocked his head back and towards Droon's tent, which the rest of the entourage now approached, McLaren at their head, flanked on his right by an armed soldier and on his left by his translator. While he likely had thought nothing of this formation, it was simply standard operating procedure in all circumstances, the darkening looks on the faces of Droon's gathered men and the way that largest among their ranks now moved to Droon's front door to cut McLaren off suggested they suspected an undercurrent of aggression. Between them, Tony and Rasheen shared a look of annoyance and mild fear before Rasheen excused himself from Riker's attention and tottered over to defuse the situation.
"What the hell does McLaren think he's doing? I told him to wait until I was ready," Tony asked Riker, whose grunt suggested he both understood Tony's apprehension but was loath to talk badly about his commanding officer.
"The colonel doesn't take kindly to following orders from those he outranks, I'm afraid."
"God damn it, I've taught Boy Scouts who knew better than to walk up to a hornet's nest shaking a stick," Tony grumbled.
Without sparing Riker a look, he began to jog over to where Rasheen was even now doing his damnedest to talk down his clearly agitated countrymen and to convince McLaren that it was to nobody's good that he walked around as if he somehow owned this or any other plot of land in Afghanistan. Not that it did any good. McLaren barely even acknowledged Rasheen, preferring, instead, to speak over his head to the Army's own translator.
"Please tell them that this is simply standard operating procedure. We don't mean them any harm. It's for their safety as much as ours."
The interpreter stammered out a broken and hardly understandable translation, which Rasheen tried to correct, but it did little good. Droon's associates ignored her to focus instead on Rasheen, who was doing a poor job of clarifying McLaren's speech, explaining to his friends that this was all a misunderstanding, and drawing attention from one of the older members of their group, who had begun banging his cane against the side of the chair he sat in, the better to demand attention.
"Tell them that if we don't, God damn it, tell them we're just following orders," McLaren blustered,
his attention clearly undone by the growing clamor around him. Tony ran up, just as the old man with the cane hobbled to his feet. "Forgive me if I speak out of line, Commander, but I don't think that's going to work with these men. I think we all just need to calm down." McLaren whipped around to fix Tony with a snarl, heavy with the implication that he understood, somehow, that this was the latter's fault.
"Know your place, Captain! This is my unit! You may pull water back in Northern Command, but here, when you are alone to us, you follow chain of command."
As if the conversation had never happened, McLaren stepped forward to the flaps of Droon's tent, bodyguard following in lockstep, and translator nervously trailing behind. Tony moved to cut in front of McLaren, again only to find his bodyguard pushing him back with his raised rifle.
"You heard the colonel," he barked,
but Tony'd had more than enough by this point. Much as he prided himself on his ability to negotiate through most any problem, there were people like McLaren who were too proud of their status to accept they were wrong. Pulling himself to his full height, He pushed at the soldier, who stumbled backwards, redoubled himself, moved up to Tony, and then thought better of it after getting a good look at him. While years spent behind desks and organizing logistics had sapped something of Tony's natural vigor and left him a bit softer than he cared to admit, he still had the basic stature of a man who held 6 still unbroken records in Kansas from his time as a quarterback in high school for the Dalton Rams, a man who might very well have gone pro if his college plans had gone just a bit differently. The private staring up at Tony might be tough for a young buck when all geared up, but he could also recognize when he was out of his league, and so backed off. Wheeling around on a shocked McLaren, Tony set about doing what he knew he should have done before they'd even left base. "No disrespect, Colonel, but I was assigned by your superiors specifically to handle these negotiations. Now, if you want to fail and spend the next 6 months trying to implement wide-sweeping reforms of the water system's infrastructure in an embattled region, hard won after decades while butting heads with a bunch of men predisposed towards hating you, after ages of martial conflict before failing miserably, explaining to your superiors that you fucked up because you didn't want to take orders from a subordinate and end up shipped back to a desk job in the middle of bumfuck Alaska, then by all means, keep on with this behavior. But if you want to let me do my job so that you can do your job, then let's get on with this, all right?" Tony could see the gears turning in the colonel's head as he came to understand that for whatever their disagreements and the difference in ranks, that Tony was right, could tell that McLaren was looking for any reasoning he could offer to get his way or at least excuse his behavior and save him from the mistake of looking irredeemably foolish in front of his subordinates and weak in front of those they were negotiating with, but was coming up short. After another beat of silence, he heard the sound of McLaren's teeth grinding, a confirmation that even if he hadn't convinced McLaren he was right, he'd at least convinced the colonel that he had no other choice. "Let's just get this over with," McLaren said with a sigh as he backed away from the tent's front, motioning for his bodyguard to follow him. The bodyguard did as ordered, but not before shooting Tony a glare that suggested he might have been cowed earlier, but would be nursing this insult until he felt he was ready to take a swing back. Tony returned the signal with a stern nod. Even if he thought the private's behavior was immature, he could sympathize with being young and eager to prove yourself, and so easily insulted when you got put in your place. He wasn't looking forward to the day he had to throw down with the kid, but if it happened, he'd be there to meet his challenge.
"I will never understand what your leaders are thinking, assigning a man like that to handle dealings in this area," Ristin murmured as he hobbled to stand next to Tony.
"Sometimes I imagine that they don't do much thinking at all."
"What, then, I've often wondered, is a man like you doing so far down on the ladder?"
"What can I say, but that I like what it is I do? I'm good at it." Ristin smiled at his friend, with goodwill, but also with a hint of what Tony could only read as the slightest bit of pity.
"Sometimes it is not enough to be good at what we love to devote ourselves to a passion. Sometimes such a devotion is a selfish waste," he said, before he frowned, turned away, and began walking past the members of Droon's entourage, still guarding the tent's entrance, leaving Tony to return back to where McLaren, Riker, and the rest of their group waited by the jeeps.
Nobody there but Riker spared him a glance as he walked up, but that hardly bothered him. Whether or not they were dissatisfied with him personally meant very little, as long as they were satisfied at the end of this endeavor.
"I'm sure this will come as no surprise when I say it, Rodriguez, but I will be nothing besides relieved when this is finally resolved and you are sent home," Riker said, his voice steady, despite an undercurrent of frustration and fear.
"I could say the same about the resolution, Major, but not about leaving. I'll miss you all." Riker sneered and let escape a dismissive little tsk, but Tony shook his head. I'm serious. We may never be friends, Riker, but you do your job and do it well. That counts for more than anybody wants to understand, especially when certain others in this outfit don't understand that duty comes first. But if Riker was touched by this compliment, he said nothing to suggest it. So the two simply stood in silence, Tony propped slightly more casually against the vehicle, in contrast to Riker's ramrod straight posture, while behind him, the colonel and his bodyguard stewed, the rest of their entourage sweating as much under the glare of Droon's companions as under the sweltering morning Afghanistan sun. Nearly an hour later, Ristine exited the house, waving over Tony, McLaren, and all the rest of their assembled unit. "Are we copacetic?" Tony asked, as he neared Ristine. Ristine answered with a shrug.
"I would wait until you've seen him yourself to venture a guess at that. He may have agreed to see you, but I would not take it to mean he cares to hear what you have to say."